welcome to the Common Geeking Program. We are a book club podcast where each week three of us are going to read up on a specific topic and then discuss it from our own geeky and nerdy perspectives. This week, I'm your host. My name is Jeff Levitt, as they call me, and we will be discussing practical effects, basically, which I will give a better definition for later. And specifically, we looked at a couple of YouTube videos, which were clips from documentaries, mostly about the first Godzilla movie, the one made in 1954 in Japan. Again, I can list the specific videos when we get to the summary, but this week I am joined by my two friends here. And
two best friends.
Yeah, definitely. We got the fucking Jeff Austin Eddie Power Hour right here. Fucking founders of the Tundra Swan Force. Right here.
That means nothing to anyone.
He just spoiled our entrances, Austin.
I'm sorry. Well, to those of you who have been listening to our podcast, you already know their voices, but let's hear who they are.
Hello, my dear listeners. My name is Edward Ryan, and today I'm going to be talking a little bit about John Carpenter's The Thing.
All right. Nice. Cool.
I'm Austin, and so I'm ready to talk about The Princess Bride, but then, like, as soon as we got online, I thought about, maybe I should talk about Alien, but we're talking about The Princess Bride.
Okay.
Alien would be cool, right?
Yeah, it would be cool. I don't know anything about how the effects work in Alien, but it sounded like it would probably be pretty...
All right, guys, imagine The Princess Bride, right?
But with more aliens.
But with a xenomorph.
And that's exactly how the effects worked in the movie Alien.
Was that guy's name Cary Elwes? Imagine him being played by a xenomorph instead.
Oh my god.
Are you the Dread Pirate Roberts?
No, I think the xenomorph would have to be Princess Buttercup.
No, that's the queen. The xenomorph queen is Princess fucking Buttercup.
Get away from her, you bitch!
Or everyone's xenomorphs except for Andre the Giant.
Oh, perfect. But that would just kind of make him Andre the small man by comparison.
Andre the regular size guy.
All right, we're going to be starting by summarizing our topic and the domains before we have an open discussion. And then finally, we're going to close with a competitive rating section. And my lovely representatives are going to tell me what they thought of the topic. And then I'm going to decide who gets the Gold Star Student Award out of the two of them for performing the best on this episode of the podcast.
You know, guys, the three-person thing is kind of a little more intimate, you know? It's like, hey, how's it going?
Yeah, I guess.
We've got one less person.
Yeah.
We're getting really real close in count here.
Okay. Exactly. Well,
without any further ado, I'd say let's shift on over to the summary. All right, boys, let's get started. We're going to go into the summary. The first clip that I had them watch, these are all on YouTube, called Bringing Godzilla Down to Size, Toho Studios Documentary. So that was the video, for your guys' memory, which was focusing on the special effects designer, not for the original Godzilla movie, but for a lot of Japanese movies that involved special effects with monster films, Yasuyuki Onoi. That was, do you want to talk about it? That was the one with the mushroom cloud.
Yeah, there's this crazy special effect that they did, and you'll see it if you watch any of those old Japanese monster movies, probably. I don't imagine it's in all of them, but, like, it looks cool, so I wouldn't put it past them.
Yeah, I think, what was the movie that this one was specifically for?
It was for one of the Godzilla movies, I thought, right?
It wasn't a Godzilla movie.
No, it was for, like, a World War II movie, right?
It was... Well, that movie apparently had a griffin in it, so it wasn't exclusively a World War II movie.
Okay, they mentioned a World War II movie.
It had a World War II-y sounding name.
Anyway, they were doing a special effect to simulate an underwater volcano.
An explosion. So they've got this big tank of water and with, like, a backdrop behind it, and it's all glass, so you can see through the tank of water because this is where the explosion's going to happen. They filmed this tank of water from underneath the water upside down so that the surface of the water looks like it's the surface of the ocean. Use your imagination. From above the tank of water, they have different colors.
So they film it upside down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Use your imagination.
I'm using it. I'm helping them because this is an audio format.
The film was called Latitude Zero, by the way.
Yeah. And then some different people pour different paints of like gray, black, and red paint that have been mixed together and thinned out a little bit so that when they fall through the water, they make like little plumes that look like smoke shooting up out of the water. And it looks like an explosion with those cameras.
Which is fucking hella cool, in my opinion.
It's very cool.
Yeah, it looks way better than I thought it was going to look, because I haven't seen these old movies.
You get the concept explained to you, and you're just like, man, that sounds like a really convoluted way to do it. And then when they actually show the footage of it, you're just like, well, you can tell it's not an actual explosion, but like, it looks pretty cool.
And it might have been in this video, or maybe it was in the next one, but one of the guys mentioned something that I thought was a pretty cogent point about this whole discussion. He made the distinction between real and reality.
Yeah.
The example he used is there have been a couple of films where, like, they've, you know, filmed, like, actual, like, building demolitions, you know, and then in their film have that as a building being destroyed. And it doesn't, like, look great or exciting. But, you know, when you take, like, a model and you, like, blow it up and, like, you have all this, like, you know, smoke and fire and everything.
It's like, wow.
Maybe the audience can go, like, yeah, that wasn't a real building, but it looks...
Right, like, the physics don't quite work the same way, but it has a certain artistry that makes it feel more real,
that makes
right?
it feel more real, yeah.
Yeah, it was, like, the prototypical Michael Bay principle.
Yeah, well, and I thought that was interesting of a distinction to make, because it's like, they're not trying to simulate perfectly reality, but they're trying to, a real thing was cool that happened, what would that look like?
Yeah, it's about it being compelling.
Yeah.
Right, and we can get into that more later, but that was pretty much the reason that I had them watch that movie. Like I said, it focused on this special effects designer, Yasuyuki Onoi, if I'm going to pronounce all these names incorrectly, just a disclaimer there. He did not work on the original Godzilla movie, but he did work on several later ones, and he was pretty renowned special effects designer in Japan. And then the other two videos I had them watch, which we're going to kind of talk about together because they're from the same documentary, are these two clips that were made by this Godzilla expert. Jesus, man, his name is harder to pronounce than all the Japanese ones. Godzilla expert Jesus. His name was Ed Godzizuki? It's not Japanese.
It's Godzizuki. Oh, Godzizuki. Yeah, Godzizuki, I just forgot a little bit of Poland in there.
Yes. His name is Ed Godzizuki. He's the narrator of these second two ones.
Let's just call him Jesus.
We'll just call him Jesus. And these second clips are called The Making of the Godzilla Suit and The Art of Suit Acting Godzilla. And those ones kind of run through the behind-the-scenes process of, like, the original trial and error of, emphasis on the error, of making of the original Godzilla suit and filming of the first Godzilla movie. So starting off with the one that's talking about more about the design than the suit actor, Ed, do you want to jump in and...
Oh, I'd love to, Jeffrey.
Talk about that.
One of the interesting things that we learned in that video... And by we, I mean me. Maybe they already knew it before they watched the video.
I didn't. I'll tell you right now.
All
right,
cool. One of the interesting things that Austin and I learned in that video was that originally they... What's the guy's name? Subaya?
Okay, well, there's a few people. The director is, which I don't think was mentioned in this video at all, but is Ishiro Honda. He's the director.
No, the guy who's in charge of special effects.
Yeah, the special effects director
is
A.G. Tsuburaya.
Tsuburaya.
Yeah, with a T-S-U.
Yeah, so Tsuburaya originally was like, yeah, well, maybe we'll do, like, you know, like miniatures and, like, stop motion animation like they did for King Kong to do Godzilla.
Yeah, the Willis O'Brien one made in 1933 was the King Kong.
He was like, that would be a good idea. And then he was like looking around and talking to people. He was like, wow, nobody in this whole darn country knows how to do miniature stop motion animation. So he was like, we need to come up with a brand new filmmaking technique to make this movie a reality. Because I'm not going to give up. What am I? A busta? I believe that's a direct quote.
Pretty much. That sounds more like the attitude of the guy who played Godzilla that we're going to talk about in the third video. The way that they were describing it was just like fucking, just like, oh yeah, you know, the suit's 130 degrees and people pass out, but I wasn't going to give up. Like,
what's that all about?
And this was, I was led to believe by the documentary, the first time this was done, they made a suit that a person would wear that was Godzilla, and then they built, like, you know, scale models of, like, cities and sets and stuff that would be, like, an appropriate size for Godzilla to be a giant towering amongst them.
As you would imagine.
You know, they made them, like, people size, which is super cool. And it's something that, like, if you didn't know, like, the history of it, it's like, yeah, isn't that what they do in, like, fucking Power Rangers?
Yeah.
But this was, like, a brand new technique that was being pioneered at this time.
I think that Godzilla sort of has this, or Godzilla and Power Rangers, you're right, sort of has this stigma of, like, oh, when people hear that it's Suitmation, it's kind of a funny image of, like, a guy running around in a big rubber suit. But kind of the point of some of these clips from the documentaries is that actually it's a pretty intensive process, both for the actor and for the design team.
No, yeah, and well, they, you know, they wanted it to look good, you know? They didn't want to make, like, just, like, a dumb, like, Halloween costume suit, you know?
Yeah, this isn't Barney.
Could you imagine if it was, though?
That would be a great
I want to make a cut of Godzilla where it's just Godzilla's cut out and it's Barney instead.
So they went through a lot of different iterations of the design before they started building it, kind of refining it from, like, a weird, like, creature from the Black Lagoon type thing to, like, a T-Rex, and then eventually
there's this point where it had, like, a weird dog-like face.
And then eventually to the Godzilla that we all know and love. And then they went through, at least for the first movie, I don't know about later ones because we didn't watch documentaries on those, two iterations of the suit. The first one, they built it and they were like, yeah, this is good.
This looks hella good. Yeah.
And then they didn't at all, because some of the materials they built it out of were, like, kind of cheap materials, so they, like, stiffened and hardened, so it was really hard for the guy to move in the suit, and the
whole thing weighed, like, 200 pounds too, right?
And the thing was really heavy. And then aside from that, they didn't take into account how they needed some of the, like, you know, joints and stuff to move. So, like, if those materials hadn't hardened like that, the guy would have been able to move a little.
It was really more of a dinosaur that you put a person into than, like, a suit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was.
There's a really funny moment in the documentary where they're just like, the suit actor got in the suit and everyone rejoiced. And then they stood there for a few seconds and realized it wasn't moving. And then he fell over.
And he fell over. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then they made another version of the suit, which was pretty much the same, but they removed some weight from, like, the upper torso and added some weight to, like, the legs. And then they changed the face a little bit, and it looked more like a dragon, which I dug. I was like, that's pretty spicy. And then that one, the guy was able to move around in, though there were still some issues.
Yeah, the suit was still pretty difficult to move in. Like, it was like 130 degrees inside the suit. I assume Fahrenheit, because Celsius would just be...
He'd be dead, yeah. He got inside the suit, they zipped it up, and he boiled to death.
And the suit actors could only stay in for a moment at a time. We don't have too much time left in the summary, so I'm not going to talk too much about the third video, but basically what it was about was kind of talking about the main suit actors for Godzilla, the main one being a guy named Haru Nakajima, who played Godzilla for like 12 consecutive films.
Why would you keep coming back?
Because he was a boss.
I mean, like, if you went to work and someone clocked you and you passed out, and then the next day you were like, I mean, I'm not a bitch, I'm going back to work.
So basically, it was talking about how difficult it was to run the suit, and we'll probably reference that later, but we don't need to get too much into it now since we are a little bit over time. But the moral of the story is that guy's a fucking badass for... and a little bit psychotic for continuing to do it.
He's like a real-life anime character.
Seriously, though. All right, friends. Now that we're onto the domains, our representatives are going to summarize what they have brought to the table. We're going to start off with Eddie. So, Eddie, why don't you... What did you say you were repping? The...
John Carpenter's The Thing.
The Thing, right. Okay, go ahead.
All
right,
hello, listeners. I've brought you a great film today. One of the greatest films that has been made. Not an exaggeration. It is the movie The Thing, made by John Carpenter. Often thought of as a remake of The Thing from Another World, but in fact, it is not. It is an adaptation of the story Who Goes There by Don Stewart, which The Thing from Another World is also an adaptation of. So it's two films made based on the same source material, but The Thing is not a direct remake. So anyway, it was made by John Carpenter. Really good movie. Basically, a bunch of, like, scientists are trapped in an outpost in Antarctica. I think it's Antarctica. It's been a little while. Should have done a little more research on the film I'm repping. And there's this alien creature who's like hunting and killing them. But the thing about it is that it can like change to look like the people that it like kills. It's like a mystery. Who done it? Who can we trust? You know, like, are you the thing?
Well, they know who done it. They just don't know who is.
Yeah. Who doing it? You know, it's like a who doing it. Kurt Russell's in it. He's great. And yeah, the movie's awesome.
Oh, I've seen The Thing from Another World. That's a very different movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't shapeshift at all. It's just like a plant dude.
So,
sorry, continue.
So the movie uses a lot of special effects, like a lot.
As one might imagine.
And they all were done practically because there wasn't really any kind of like computer effects at the time. So, you know, you've got this alien creature who's like changing shape and doing all this crazy stuff. I'm going to explain some of it in a second, but it's all done practically. It's by this guy, Rob Bottin, was the special effects supervisor on the film, and he's super good. And it was one of his like earlier movies too. So he is like a special effects prodigy or some shit. So, I'm going to give a couple examples, I guess. There's a scene in the movie. This is one of the cooler ones. There's a scene in the movie where there's a person who's like dead or dying, and they're like, oh, we're going to, you know, we got like the, defibrillator. We're going to like defibrillate him and bring him back. Right.
Yeah.
So the one character grabs the defibrillator, you know, he does the thing and he like throws his hands down to shock the guy, but the guy is the thing. And the thing's like a whole torso opens up, right? Just flies open, right? Gore,
yeah.
Blood, bones everywhere. The guy's arms go inside because he was pushing his arms down. The torso closes on his arms and rips his arms off, right? And so none of this is like CG because it didn't really exist. They had to make all this. So they had to make this thing that looked like a person where the whole torso cavity would fly open and then reclose. And then for the arms ripping off, what they did was they replaced the actor with a guy who had no arms, with a double amputee. And they made fairly accurate mask of the actor and had the double amputee wear that mask. And then they made fake arms for
That's
him.
That's crazy.
And they had him wear the fake arms. So,
That's
it's all
great.
Fake, but it all really happens. And this is actually similar to what they were talking about, the, like, real versus reality thing in the Toho Studios video. It's all fake, but the guy really takes these arms and reaches them into this open chest cavity, and the chest cavity closes and rips the arms off, and there's blood and gore everywhere.
That's pretty incredible, honestly.
It's super cool. And one of the interesting things about The Thing is that Rob Bottin and John Carpenter, they were very interested in doing as many of the effects as they could as, like, live effects, rather than doing, like, stop motion, like you see in films like The Evil Dead or a bunch of other ones from that same era. So they had to make all these, like, mechanical things that they could control in certain ways to do a lot of these special effects that they were doing. Like, there's one part where a guy's head splits in half and opens up into, like, a maw, eats another dude.
As you do.
And, like, they made all these, like, contraptions and then decorated them up to, you know, look as real as they possibly could with, like, fake blood and gore and latex and all and rubber and all this stuff. And that's why I wanted to bring The Thing today. I might talk about a little more examples in the discussion, but we'll see. Thank you very much for listening to me, everybody, especially Jeff.
All right, Austie Cakes, my friend.
Yeah.
Where are you at with this thing? What did you bring? You know what? Dude. Alien or Princess Bride? What did you decide?
No, Princess Bride. I made a decision. It may have been the wrong decision, but it was a decision,
but
and I like it.
We're going to stick with it. All right,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Tell me about The Princess Bride and why you brought it.
The Princess Bride is this great movie, and it's also apparently a really good book that I definitely need to read, but we're talking about the movie because books don't have practical effects.
God, unless they're a pop-up book.
Unless they're a pop-up book.
It really is, though. Like, that's a good... Anyway, we're not going to talk about pop-up books. Go on, sorry.
Today I brought my first day at school, a pop-up book.
Yeah, so there are, like, a couple things with The Princess Bride. It, you know, doesn't really use a lot of special effects at all. It's, like, tiny little bit of... I mean, most people, I imagine, have seen The Princess Bride because it's such a classic movie.
If you haven't, pause the podcast right now. Go watch The Princess Bride.
Yeah, you have to go watch The Princess Bride. It's just this movie about, like, in the movie, this isn't how the book is, but it's a frame narrative where this grandfather is reading this book to this little boy who doesn't want to read this fucking fairy tale book because he wants to play his baseball video games. And then the grandpa tells him this story about this princess who is in love with this boy, and this boy's in love with this princess, but then they think the boy died, so then she's gonna get married to the prince of the fucking land because he's a big piece of shit and he's just, I don't know, trying to break hearts and stuff.
And this is a comedy.
Yeah, it's a romantic comedy and adventure fantasy film. And then there's this big adventure where she tries to escape from the prince, and the prince has people chasing after her, and then she gets kidnapped by some people, and then the Dread Pirate Roberts comes into the mix.
Yeah, okay. We get the gist of the plot of the film. Yeah.
That's the film. But what I'm talking about for this particular episode is they do include some practical effects work in a couple places in the movie, but what I really want to talk about is when they go into this huge swamp, the princess and the Dread Pirate Roberts. And there are a couple things here. Like, the swamp has some, because there are gases released from the decaying matter inside the swamp, they have jets of flame that come out of the ground every so often, which is just kind of cool. You know, it's not it's kind of a dangerous effect to do a little bit. Nothing crazy. Nothing
fucking Godzilla suit levels.
Here, first, because you mentioned it, they do have the rodents of unusual size, which when the Dread Pirate Roberts and Princess Buttercup get attacked by these rodents of unusual size, the very large unusual size, it is a person in a rat suit who's doing, like, who's, like, flailing around on top of the Dread Pirate while the two of them are fighting, and it's nuts. It's, like, it's absurd. It's not so much trying to be serious like Godzilla, but, like, it's super campy, and it's, like, you know that in this world, these characters are really concerned about it, but it's sort of, it looks absurd on screen, and it's very silly.
So it's sort of using the practical effects to make it sort of comedic,
yeah,
in a way?
And, yeah, exactly.
That's interesting.
And I thought that was super cool, especially because, they have a suit that the person wears to be the rat, right? But for the first scene where the rat comes onto the screen, well, for the first shot where the rat comes onto the screen, the rat jumps onto the Dread Pirate, and they don't have a person in a suit. They just throw the rat suit at him, so it looks like it's jumping. And it's fucking brilliant. Anyway, I thought that part was amazing. But there's also another part, another shot later in the swamp, where Princess Buttercup gets swallowed up by some quicksand, because, you know, all those movies that you watched when you were kids were really about quicksand, and then you grew up and you're like, there's no quicksand anywhere. Why were they so concerned about it?
They just really wanted everyone to know that quicksand was a problem.
But it wasn't! It's just not...
But, like, where do you fucking even encounter quicksand?
Yeah. Anyway, So the quicksand, the way that they filmed the quicksand was kind of cool, actually, because they had, like, they had this pit of sand, and they had a trapdoor underneath the sand, and then underneath the trapdoor, they had a little, like, padded room area where they would wait while, like, people were getting sucked in or climbing out of the quicksand. And it was a pretty cool effect for them to do, because there's a point where the Dread Pirate has to jump into the quicksand to save Princess Buttercup. And so the actor had to dive in headfirst at this trapdoor while it was closed, and then the special effects team had to open it up while he was diving in at the right time so that, like, not all of the sand came out, like, before he touched it, and so that he wouldn't hit his head. Anyway, so apparently they got that on the first take, but it was some super cool stuff.
That's a lot of trust on the part of,
of the actor. Yeah. It's a good thing they got on the first take, because otherwise the first take would have been him snapping his neck. Like,
oh, we missed it, guys. Bring the next one in.
All right. Well, thank you, Austin. That was informative. I actually have not seen The Princess Bride in a very long time, so I don't remember a lot of these things, but thank you for refreshing my memory, and I think we're going to be moving on. Okay, Anyway, friends, with all of our topics and domains summarized, I think we're going to be moving on to the discussion portion of this podcast.
There's one thing we didn't summarize, and that's the definition of practical effects.
Yeah.
For those of you who are uninitiated, a practical effect is a kind of special effect that is made, like, physically instead of with CGI, which is computer-generated imagery. So, made with props, like the Godzilla suit and stuff from The Thing, or, like, some kind of effect like the paint cloud that we talked about from the first video. I think that there has been made a certain distinction between special effects can kind of be defined as either way. The distinction really is between practical effects and visual effects, whereas visual effects are usually manipulated by computer stuff.
Like if you shoot a guy with a gun and you film it, that's not a practical effect. That's murder.
Yeah, and if you capture a real animal, like a gerbil or an alien from X-Files, on camera, that's not practical effects, that's just filmography.
Yeah.
So sometimes they blend together, but mostly we're talking about just kind of creative practical effects and special effects. I don't know, would you guys say that that's a good description?
I think you did great, Jeffrey.
I hope so, because it was a paraphrase from the Wikipedia article on practical effects.
Oh, I disagree then.
Well, no, the one thing that I just don't know is that, like, if you say all special effects go under either practical effects or visual effects that are, like, CGI, I'm not sure where you'd put, like, the proto-visual effects stuff, like the original lightsaber effect in Star Wars. Wasn't that done by, like, editing the actual film to, like, draw in the little blade on it?
So,
I don't know, it's like animation, I don't know.
Yeah. So,
I think that's still, well, what the Wikipedia article says is it's more about doing it in post versus doing it in the actual production.
Okay.
So, practical effects would be if they actually had a glowing thing.
Yeah, so with the drawing the lightsaber blades in.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's like CG, like, before just minus CG. The computer.
Yeah.
Like,
It's just G.
It's just G.
It's a generated image.
Yeah. I mean, isn't everything really?
The Star Wars is an interesting example, the lightsaber specifically, because what they had was, they had the hilt, obviously, and then on it, they had, like, three reflective, strips. Three, you know, long, like, reflective things, and then they had the lights pointed at them in a certain way, so that they would have this, like, glow and hue about them.
Okay.
And then that glow is what they, like, colored in post, so it's like a weird mix of like a practical effect and then like a post animation effect.
Yeah, that's funky.
The lightsabers.
Yeah, so, but ultimately it was edited in post, so it would more fall into visual effects than practical effects.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of like mocap suits, though, too, you know? Like, well, maybe not exactly like that, but the fact that they film something and then use that as a reference for where the actual object should end up in post-production, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Or it's like, in the documentary you had us watch, a bunch of the guys mentioned near the end of, I think, the second video, how, you know, they don't have any problem with, like, CG effects.
They just don't want it to replace their industry.
They just think that using only CG, like, doesn't look as good and it doesn't feel as good. They think, like, ultimately the best place to land would be, like, a mix.
Yeah.
And there are some great examples we have of that, like Jurassic Park, where they built these big animatronic dinosaurs. And then they used computer effects to clean up some of the stuff on the animatronics to make it look more alive.
Yeah.
And then, like, to do some of the, like, motion and stuff as well that they couldn't accomplish on such a large scale with, like, a mechanical effect.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's going to bring me to my my first real question, and answer this in whatever order and try to tie in your own movies, but, you know, just whatever feels natural. So a lot of these people were talking about how the sort of blend of practical and visual effects is sort of what makes it feel the most nuanced. Do you think that there's anything to that? Like, do you think that there's something inherently about the practical effects that does make it feel more more real? Or do you think that if CGI gets advanced enough, then it could totally take over?
I mean, makes it feel more real. I think that, like, at this point, there are still, like, a lot of movies where you can tell, like, oh yeah, this scene is so CGI. Like, this is obviously all just, like, a person standing in front of a green screen and, like, pantomiming stuff. But, like, also sometimes, like, CGI looks really good, but I find that, like, a lot of the times that I think CGI looks really cool is either when you're, like, looking at things from a huge distance, like, say, the battles in Lord of the Rings stuff where it's, like, a bunch of people on the ground, but they're far away, so you don't see how alien they kind of look, or when it's combined with practical effects. Like, yeah. The one that I saw recently was Shape of Water. I think they definitely combined practical effects for all the glowy stuff on the fishman suit, but, like, it was a really cool-looking suit. Because I don't know that I would say, like, it always makes things more real to have practical effects in there, because, like, how I was talking about with The Princess Bride, like, I think that The Princess Bride consciously makes it look more absurd with its practical effects.
Right,
but
yeah.
Also, that's... I don't think that's just because, like, that's what they're doing purposefully. I think it's possible that if the same studio had a larger budget and more resources from the present way back in 1987, maybe it would have looked more real. I could see that happening, but also, like, it would mess with the tone of the movie, because the movie is, like,
right.
a happy romp, and they wanted it to be campy, not, like, fucking scary.
Yeah, and I think that
scary.
The presence of the practical effects, especially suitmation making it more campy, is something that we might want to touch on later, but first I want to give Ed an opportunity to answer that same question if he's got any different insights to it.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey.
I got you.
I mean, I agree with Austin's point that there's not really like a catch-all, like CG always looks better or practical always looks better. I think in a lot of cases I prefer practical because it does kind of have a quality to it where it's like it's a thing that's actually there and you can tell.
Yeah.
That's not to say that there haven't been instances where CG has been done well enough that you can't tell that it's not something that's actually there.
Right.
You know, and some of that'll have to do with, like, you know, them either, like, doing motion capture or them placing, like, actual physical objects for the actors to interact with and then replacing them in post with the, like, fantastical CG object.
Kind of like the porgs in the most recent Star Wars movie. Right?
Yeah. And, well, and the other thing with the porgs, though, is that's an instance where...
this is funny.
They were like puffins, right?
Like, they based them off those puffins.
Yeah.
But then they built actual physical puppets of the porgs.
Yeah.
And then for the ones that they CG'd, they had that physical model to base the CG off of rather than constructing it just off of like a drawing or something.
Right. Which is pretty neat.
Which is an interesting way to do it. But then we have things like the most recent Jungle Book film, where aside from, like, the kid who plays Mowgli and some of the objects that he holds, the entire film is computer generated, and it looks very real.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think a lot of with the computer generated thing about whether or not it's going to look real is obviously it's with the skill of the people doing it, but then also just the time that they put into it. You know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true.
That's a movie that was being made for like over 2 years, you know?
Right.
Where if you're trying to, you know, pump out like a 90-minute action movie and you're trying to make it in like 8 months and then get it out there and make as much money as you can real fast, you're not going to spend as much time on that stuff and it's not going to look as good. And I think that is the same thing though with the practical effects is like it's, you know, obviously a large part of it is the skill of the creator, but then also it's
right.
the time that they spend doing it. Because there are movies with practical effects that look horrible because they just whip them
true.
Up real quick, you know?
Or like there are episodes of the Power Rangers.
I would say that bad practical effects look just as bad as bad CGI,
Power Rangers is a good example. They're making like a weekly children's TV show that they don't have a huge budget.
Yeah.
So like they build these like monster suits that don't look amazing. And they build these sets that don't look amazing. And it's fine for their purpose, but it's something that's kind of, I think, given a little bit of a bad name to, like, the suit acting. Is that what you were calling it?
Yeah, suitmation, suit acting.
Suitmation, yeah. So, yeah, I think it depends on the context, and it's depends on the artists involved and the amount of time that they're allowed to or willing to put into the craft.
Yeah, I think one more thought that I had about it was just that, like, I don't know, you know, it's like a matter of preference. Like, obviously, all these people who spent so much time working on practical effects are going to feel attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, obviously people whose professions are in CGI or who, like, really like the magic of computer stuff are going to be impressed by that.
Right.
But, like, you know, in most stuff, it's never, like, neither of these techniques ever really, like, fool an audience into thinking a thing is real unless they're used in a really subtle way.
Yeah.
So it's, like, you know, it feels practical. It feels CGI. It's just, like, I don't know, two completely different things that get, like, similar results occasionally.
That's a good point. And I don't know, I'd like to talk a little bit about, like, I think that one of the things that kind of draws us to practical effects in some cases more than visual effects with CGI and stuff like that, people who are sort of have not, like, looked into it are like, oh yeah, it's funny, he's in a big rubber suit with Godzilla, right? But something that really makes me like it is that when you listen to people talk about, like, the actual work that goes into these things, a lot of times there's a lot of very clever solutions to problems. A lot of times I think that the practical effects sort of have a more sort of like a zanier kind of like, oh, that's a strange way to think how to do that, you know?
No, I get what you mean.
Yeah. Do you think that, like, affects the tone of the movie?
Like a creative, like, problem solve in, like, a CG thing, if you're explaining to someone, you'd be like, oh, well, I had to change these values and I had to add this mask to throw a sub mask under it with this effect. And people would be like, oh, okay. But, like, you know, you're like, we had to tape up the Godzilla suit with duct tape and bubble gum. And it's like, no!
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Exactly.
I get what you're saying. It's like, because the average person has more experience with, like, things that they interact with in the real world.
Right.
Than with binary.
Than with how, yeah, with how a computer program for filmmaking works. So it's easier for someone to relate to.
So it makes the behind the scenes seem a little bit more interesting. Yeah, you're right, because it makes it easier for them to relate to because it's not as
abstract.
Yeah, it's not as abstract. Yeah,
even though the CG work is still very impressive, it's not as easy to relate to because you're like, oh, yeah, you used a computer, cool.
Right. And I don't know, I guess I was just wondering if, like, you guys had any opinion on that, and do you think that practical effects enhance a film even more so once you know how it was done? Like, does it make you appreciate the rest of the film as much, or is it, like, separate from the effects being used in the film?
Yeah, I think it makes me appreciate the film in, like, that, in sort of, like, a historical context, you know? Like, because... I think I generally appreciate practical effects in that sense more than I appreciate outdated CGI stuff.
That's fair.
Because, like, a lot of times, like, if you look at, like, really old CGI stuff, you might say, well, you could have done this with a practical effect, and it probably would have looked better. Like, I'm thinking, like, the first season of the current running series of Doctor Who, they had some effects that you were just like, eh, you could have used a suit.
Their budget definitely got a lot better in season two, but, like, no, I agree. In season one, there were just some, like, totally egregious things that are like, I'm pretty sure I saw the camera move, but the image of the alien stayed in the same place on the screen.
Yeah, and like, you know, sometimes when you're looking at the development of practical effects, it feels like you can only go so far because, like, the advancement of digital technology has way less of a limit than many ways you can build a monster suit.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's one of the appeals of practical is that the thing, perceptually, looks the same today as it did in 1982.
Right.
Whereas, you know, if you watch something like The Phantom Menace, right?
Yeah.
Some of the special effects in The Phantom Menace looked amazing and astonishing and groundbreaking when the movie came out.
Yeah, I mean, even like Jar Jar Binks, right? Like,
yeah. Like, disregard your opinion on the film as a story. Some of that looked amazing.
Yeah.
And now today you go back and watch it and you're like, wow, some of this looks like hot garbage.
Yeah.
These textures.
It's a perspective thing, I think, because practical effects, they're a thing that exists in the real world, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, that's what it is. That's the thing. Whereas with, like, a CG effect, it's like, you make, like, a spaceship. And it's like, wow, that looks so amazing. That looks like a real spaceship. And 10 years later, there's a different film that makes a way better spaceship.
Yeah.
That looks way more realistic. And then you go back and watch that other one, and you're like, wow, that spaceship doesn't look real at all. It doesn't even look close to, like, what a real spaceship looks like.
I mean, I think going off of that, though, I think that You're right, probably to a lesser degree, but I think some of that can be true of practical effects as well. Like, in some of the earlier Godzilla movies, it's not like the sculpting on the suit was any better or worse, but they kind of got a hang of it, so that when you look at some later Godzilla movies and, like, look at the practical effects, they're kind of filmed in a way that makes it look a lot more realistic. So then when you go back and you watch the first one, it does look kind of silly by comparison, like you're describing with CG. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't necessarily think it's the case that movies made with practical effects look the same to us now as they did when they came out. I think that there still could have been like an astonishing sort of view when it was the first thing that was ever done like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the original King Kong, you know, was made with stop motion, right?
Yeah.
And we've seen way better stop motion since then. But at the moment of that movie's release, it was like an incredible, groundbreaking new technique, you know?
Yeah. Well, so I think you're correct, and that what I said was wrong. So let me rephrase it so that I'm also correct.
Eddie's trying to get his points here.
No, I'm not.
I know, I'm just teasing.
No, this is just natural.
So I think that the same thing happened with practical effects. You're right, but the practical effects was something that didn't evolve as quickly as computer-generated effects do.
Yeah, that's true.
Because we're in a moment where that type of technology is moving very quickly, you know?
Yeah. And I think Austin is right. I think it does have limits to practical effects.
So it's more easily perceptible. And also, practical effects, for the most part, already went through those, like, growing pains as an art.
Yeah.
And computer-generated effects are still going through them. You know?
Because it keeps getting better such that you think, oh, that was bad.
Yeah, and it's getting better at a faster rate than practical effects did.
Because that's fair.
Computers are fast and building stuff in real life is less fast.
True.
Also, I don't know, I feel like because CGI is like progressing so quickly and people are like, oh, it's so much better this year, we like have this expectation for new CGI movies to look really real this time. And like when we watch Godzilla movies, if we're not just watching it to laugh at how silly things were in the 50s or whatever, like when we watch them, we suspend our disbelief in a way that we generally don't for new CGI movies. Like, you know, like you noticed like when one of the Michael Bay movies had one of the Transformers clipping through the Lincoln Memorial and you're like, what the fuck is that shit?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We were watching it and I paused the movie and I was like, do you fucking see this? His wheel is going through the ground.
So, well, and that's the other thing is, like, if they had built a giant transformer to sit on the Lincoln Memorial, it would not have clipped through. That's all I'm saying.
That's
and
true.
It wouldn't have looked as real, but we would have been like, oh, this is a transformer. That's what it's representing. I'll suspend my disbelief about the bug eyes on this costume right now.
No,
and I don't know.
I think you're absolutely right, is that, like, we are a bit more forgiving of practical effects because we do have this sort of expectation that it won't advance at quite the rate, and we kind of appreciate it for what it is. Whereas CGI, I think people kind of have the concept that it's like a sort of cheap, easy form of practical effects when that's just not the case.
Yeah, and that goes back to what Eddie was talking about, where people are like, oh, it's just computer magic that people do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I think, though, an interesting question that I have for you guys, I'm asking the questions now, Jeff, is do we think that that is something that is caused by, like, the filmmakers who make a lot of these, like, CG-heavy films, or is that something that the audience is projecting onto them? Are the films, like, trying to be more real with their CG, and that's why we judge them more harshly, or are we just expecting that they'll be more real with the CG? Because, like, there's films like, trying to think of an example, Crap.
Yeah, I had no idea where I was going earlier. I just pulled the Transformers thing out of my ass because I remembered that incident.
Yeah.
Austin always gets points for bringing up Transformers in one of my episodes. You guys are going head-to-head right now.
All right, well then, let's keep on the Transformers train. There's films like Transformers, though. I think the target audience of Transformers, they're not going in going, oh, they're going to be so realistic this time. It's going to look like there's really Transformers. They're going in like, this is going to be some sweet robot action explosion fights.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas when you go see something, you know, like James Cameron's Avatar, if that looked like doo-doo, everyone would be like, that didn't look real at all.
Yeah, that's true. I want to transition a little bit because I do want to talk about the Princess Bride a little bit, because there was some aspect of it that I think was sort of unique to bring up here, in that in The Princess Bride, it seemed like the suitmation was used as a parody and like as a form to add a comedic value to the film and make it feel campy, a la, you know, old Power Rangers and stuff like that. So
yeah,
Power Rangers wasn't around.
Sorry. You're right. Thank you.
You could have just said Godzilla, like the main thing that we're talking about.
So really just the monster movies. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, Godzilla, but the distinction I was trying to make is that Godzilla is not meant to feel campy. It's just, well, actually, I don't know. Now that I say that, there were some later examples of Godzilla films that were meant to feel campy. And
like when he had a child.
Do you think, like, I guess I'm just going to try to open the floor for Austin here to talk a little bit about, like, the way that it was used in a sort of comedic way, because I think that can be done with CGI as well, but
yeah,
it definitely has different effects, so I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how it would be done with CGI, but I mean, I don't know, because I guess, like, definitely the use of just these big rubber animal suits with different materials on them definitely was influenced by Godzilla and stuff
and kaiju films. Yeah,
but I also see like the ridiculous things. I always think of like the Dark Crystal and the Neverending Story.
Yeah.
Those movies are supposed to be super serious, but I can't really take them that seriously
because of the way the puppets look. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know. That's
Atreyu.
I don't know. I just What was the little seed of this question?
I was saying, like, in The Princess Bride, it was used as...
Oh, like, to flout
purposefully
the...
Purposefully comedic. But that was probably by necessity to a degree, though, don't you think? Because, like, I don't know what other route they could have done that and made it not a joke, but also made it, like, look good and within the budget of the film, right?
Yeah, I think, like, it works because the film is supposed to be light and silly.
Yeah.
It does. I think it does that in the place of like some really funky things that I'm told that the author did with the book,
mm-hmm.
where like the way the book was released, you can't translate a lot of these things into the movie because the book was released as the abridged edition of a book that this other guy had written, allegedly, where it was like he makes a bunch of like jokes about the way that histories and stuff are written, and there are like parts where he'll say, and then the editor will say, and then the author went on for like 17 chapters about like the trade history of this certain thing, and like all the characters like super dumb and they don't see things that are obviously gonna happen, like if you know anything about plot structure or anything,
right.
And you can't make jokes like that, like little footnotes and things in a movie.
Right.
So you have to take advantage of the tools you have at your disposal.
I mean, you could. I don't know if you've seen A Series of Unfortunate Events starring Jim Carrey.
I mean, the thing that they could have done, and they did this to an extent, was they used the frame narrative to have the grandpa talking to the little kid about the movie while it was happening.
Right.
They would like take little breaks.
Yeah,
like when Wesley and Buttercup are gonna kiss and they cut away from it, like there's this dramatic music swelling and they cut away and there's this little like 10-year-old like, ew, it's that kind of book, grandpa.
Yeah. And they get some of that with that, but also I think like it was happy coincidence, I guess, that that's what they had. I think even if they made the movie today, I don't think that they would have. I think if I trust them that they wouldn't have made the rodents of unusual size like actually giant rat CGI monsters.
Yeah.
I don't think it would look very good, but I also just like was playing Dark Souls 3 earlier and giant rats are horrifying, so I don't know. Maybe it would just have been too scary for me. Yeah, Eddie?
So if you were gonna do something like the rodents of unusual size joke today, like parodying CG instead of practical effects, what you'd do, it'd be easy. You just have all the actors looking at the wrong place and you'd have a really bad CG rat that instead of like moving around in a way that looked real, you'd have it like just like the image of it moved across the screen while like the legs move in like a weird independent way. And they'd be like, oh my God, you know, like overacting about it. Like it the same joke plays today, I think, but I agree that in the film of The Princess
Bride, sort
of like
Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus.
Yeah, like that's just asylum movies. We don't respect those in nearly the way that we even respect The Princess Bride.
Speak for yourself.
No, but they're not doing it as a joke. I'm saying.
I think they are though.
If The Princess Bride were made today and they were doing that kind of joke, but with CGI as the base, like they'd do something like that. You know, like I think the same joke works. But yeah. That was my response to Austin. And I guess since we're getting done soon, I'll say another thing about the thing.
Okay. Another thing about things.
I'm going to say a negative about practical effects, but okay, it's not really a negative. So Austin was talking about how there was like the, you know, the flames in the swamp,
mm-hmm.
and there was like the sand pit where like he could have hurt himself. So there's this one scene in the thing where like the Kurt Russell has lit the thing on fire.
Yeah.
It like detaches its head from like its body so like it can like crawl away as just a head to like live to kill another day.
Yeah. Yep.
And so they like to film this, like they've got like the whole contraption with the head and the body, and then they've got like this like stuff that they're gonna light on fire to have burning through the scene so that there's flames for a right. real fire. So they light it and the room explodes. And so everything's on fire and everyone is just yeah. staring at it like, oh, there's a fire. And apparently John Carpenter looks at Rob Bottin and he goes, put it out, you idiot.
Well, see, that's the interesting thing about practical effects that I think in some way makes it slightly more appreciable or slightly less, depending how you're looking at it, is that, like, sometimes it can get pretty fucking dangerous. Like, the things that they were describing with the Godzilla movie,
yeah.
like, the conditions that they described this suit actor having to go under, and the fact that the only reason he was really putting up with it is because he was a stubborn badass, was, like, you know, he would have, like, pyrotechnics lit at his feet while he was in this hot suit that he could barely move in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that movie could not be made today.
Yeah, they said that, like, oh, he couldn't...
just legally.
Yeah, they said that he couldn't stay in the suit for more than a few minutes at a time without risk of, like, passing out, and, like, yeah. they would drench, like, a cup of sweat from the suit every time he moved. Like,
mm-hmm.
it can get pretty dangerous in a lot of these more ambitious sort of projects. Which is, yeah. like, I think something that makes it kind of interesting, but also, like, maybe is a, well, definitely is a potential downside to it, you know?
That was something that yeah. I thought about when I was watching that video, is that, like, I was like, oh, yeah, this is just, like, a way worse version of the stuff that I did in Little Shop of Horrors, where I was part of the ensemble, but they also had me on the cast because, like, I could lift up the fucking... because
you were a strong boy.
The plant costume. Yeah, I was a strong boy doing sports and stuff, and it was a sweaty time, and I had an extra shirt in there for when we did the curtain call so that I wouldn't be wearing sweaty black clothes in front of the audience.
Yeah, that is a good example of practical effects. It's like play acting, you know?
Theater, yeah. It has to be practical effects.
And this has been an intimate evening with Jeffrey, Austin, and Edward.
Well, thank you both for a very informative discussion. We are now going to be moving on to the ratings section. We're going to begin with having our representatives rate the topic on a scale from 1 to 5 iterations of the Godzilla suit. So obviously by the 5th iteration, it'll be a lot more advanced and a lot better. But the first iteration, you can't move in at all.
So let's hope we get there for the actor's sake.
And this is a little weird because I'm not going to have them rate just the documentaries or the concept of practical effects, but more the practical effects that were talked about in the documentaries.
Yeah, fuck this whole sub-discipline.
So we're going to start with Eddie. On a scale from 1 to 5 iterations of the Godzilla suit, how did you like what I brought today?
Hey, what's up, Jeffrey? So it's a little bit hard of a thing to rate.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, I'll say it first. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 Godzilla suits.
Iterations of the Godzilla
suits. Yeah.
These aren't all the same. They get better over time.
I enjoyed the documentary clips that you had us watch. I thought we learned about a lot of cool special effects and stuff in there, and the like ways that they were made and the process and everything. But I think the reason I'm giving it such a high rating is because it opens up a lot of interesting discussion. Which is, I think it did today on this episode of the podcast.
Yeah,
so,
I think this was fun.
Because it's such a weird thing to rate, maybe I'm rating it a little too high because I enjoyed recording this with you guys, but 4 out of 5.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm also going to give it a 4 out of 5 iterations of the Godzilla suit because, like, I thought it was really cool. I don't know. I think it's fun to learn about stuff, and I trust that they weren't lying to me, so... It was cool, and also, like, it's not, like, learning about something that was lame, because, like, even though you're like, oh yeah, they were just in a suit, you don't know their details,
yeah.
but now we know. So, you know.
Turns out it was some pretty fucking intense shit, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you guys for those good 4 out of 5s.
No, thank you, Jeffrey.
You're welcome.
Did I mention Transformers?
Well, you know who we should really thank? We should really thank...
Fucking Haru.
Yeah, we should really thank Eiji Tsurabaya.
Yeah. I was gonna say fucking Haru Nakajima, the suit actor.
Oh, yeah. He's real important, too, but I don't know.
We should thank him, and we should thank Jesus for making that documentary.
I feel like we sort of referenced what Haru Nakajima did, but we never actually talked about it. So you like got a sense of what we were talking about, but we never described it, which is not to say that we should now.
So,
but
real quick, can we call this episode Godzilla 2 Electric Boogaloo?
Oh my God. We could. It's the second Godzilla episode of this podcast. Anyway, so we are going to be now moving on.
If you guys haven't seen Break Into Electric Boogaloo, don't pause the podcast. Don't go watch it. Just keep listening.
God damn it. Now we're going to be moving on to giving the Gold Star Student Award to the person who I think did the best on this podcast.
Oh, this is weird now, because like it's a more direct competition with only two people.
Yeah, I know. It's like every episode is a versus episode.
Yeah, it's a more intimate competition.
You can't have like two people being like, oh, good for you. It's got to be like...
It's got to be like a winner and a loser. There is no company for your misery. You're just alone.
I'm in the business of misery.
And
not yet, you're not.
But basically, I'm just going to be talking about who brought the best thing to the table. I think both of my podcast representatives did a good job at giving each other the floor and being respectful of each other. And I recognize that the discussion kind of talked about a few more things than just the domains and the topic. But I think that we were all guilty of that. So
I think it was productive.
I agree.
See, now, I've given the fucking ratings was the Godzilla suits, but I was thinking of doing the Golden Godzilla suit as the Gold Star.
Mm.
You know, I mean, that would be unprecedented, Jeffrey.
Oh, don't fucking tell me what I can't do.
I didn't say you can't do it. I'm saying it would be unprecedented to have the Gold Star and the ratings be the same.
Would it be unprecedented? Yeah, I think...
Well,
yeah.
I think in episode 3, you got the 5 golden schmeckles for...
No, it was the schmeckles, and then it was the golden plumbus, right?
But it wasn't, though. He said that in, like, the middle of the episode, and then he ended up giving you 5 golden schmeckles as the thing.
So it's precedented. Is what you're saying.
We're gonna have to research this, but there may be a precedent.
Yeah, Eddie, you
we'll have to check the bylaws.
I was gonna say it.
Eddie was really the host in this situation, and that's why he gets the Gold Star Student Award.
Fucking bullshit.
He gets a 5 out of 5 schmeckles.
Good job!
I am going to be giving the Golden Godzilla suit today.
Giving out the Golden Godzilla suit? Yep. That's your prerogative, Jeffrey, and I'm proud of you for taking it.
But, like, the first iteration of the Godzilla suit, so if you get inside of it, then you won't be able to breathe or move.
And also it's made of gold, so you'll fucking die.
I think that both of you did a really good job. There was a lot of good discussion opening up. I am going to say that the Golden Godzilla suit today is going to be going to a Mr. Edward Ryan.
Thank you.
Because probably both of you could have gone a little bit more into both of your domains, but I think you were both kind of equal on that front. I think that Eddie brought up some pretty good points, and if I were a smart boy, then I would have written them down to cite them right now, but I was not, so... But there were a few things that Eddie said in there, and Austin as well, but I think a few more things that Eddie said that really caught my attention. So I think that's why I'm going to be giving Eddie the Golden Godzilla suit today. Congratulations, Eddie.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. I'd like to thank Haru Nakajima.
Oh, I regret this already.
And I'd like to thank God and Jesus, and baby Jesus, all 3 of them.
What about, are you going to thank anime too? Yeah.
I'd like to thank the wonderful art of anime.
I've got the powers of God and anime on my side.
I think it was a good clean fight out there. You know, he landed some hits, I landed some hits, but you know, ultimately I think I put in a little bit more of the training, you know, studied his technique beforehand, and that's what allowed me to bring home the belt tonight. You know, next time though, he's gonna be a formidable opponent. I'm gonna have to really stay on top of my game if I wanna think about coming out of this next one with the victory. Thank you, Cleveland. Good night.
And for those of you keeping track, that now shoves Eddie into tied for first place with, ready for this, Colin, Laura, and Pat. You guys
get wrecked.
Yeah, you guys all have 7 gold stars. I mean, I guess if you really want to interpret this, and I think you're going to interpret it this way, just judging by your personality, but technically...
Yeah, no, it doesn't count. I know what you're going to say.
Technically,
no,
Eddie has 7.5 because Matt represented on his behalf once. All right, guys, I think that about wraps it up. Thank you for listening to the Common Geeking Program. Again, I am your host. My name is Jeff Levitt, and you can, oh, geez, find me. I don't have a Twitter or anything. I'm on Facebook, but I don't do anything relevant on there.
You can find him in real life.
Yeah, you can just hunt me down.
There will be a scavenger hunt to locate his address.
I do have a website, which I have not gotten a shortened URL for, so I'm going to list off the really long one and hopefully not do that in the future, but it is jeffreylevitt13@wixsite.com/thingsiwishexisted is the URL. Have fun with that. And my name is spelled JeffreyLevitt.
Like a real person.
Or as it is in the credits. And again, I've been joined by my lovely reps this week, Eddie Ryan and Austin Liebers. Do either of you have some social media that you'd like to pimp out or not?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at fake Eddie Ryan.
I thought he was making that up the first time he said it.
No. you can find me you can find me on Twitter at fake Eddie Ryan.
Lovely.
That's all I'm plugging today.
Austin, how about yourself?
You're going to have to try harder if you want to find me, I think,
okay,
at this point in time.
And next week, our episode is going to be hosted by Austin. Austin Cakes, what are you going to be talking about?
Well, next week, I'm going to be starting a funky little segment that we're going to be doing here. That's the Creative Corner. And I'm going to have some little kids come onto this podcast and do some creation. Also, I mean, not literally. I'm not literally bringing children onto the podcast. It's going to be Eddie and Keenan.
I'm a big boy.
So basically, children.
They're big boys now, and they're going to create big boy art.
I believe that both Keenan and I don't know what this art is. So when you listen to the podcast, you'll hear us find out live.
Thank you, Austin. That description was both slightly vague, but also mysterious enough to keep us interested. That episode is going to be airing next Friday on the 2nd of March, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah.
We are doing a thing where we are posting, I believe every Monday, about an upcoming topic to solicit some listener-submitted questions. We did have that up for this recording, but we didn't get anything, so we didn't talk about it, but that is a thing that we are doing from now on.
And those can be questions about the topic or anything.
The topic, specifically.
I don't know. I saw the post Colin made. He said anything.
Oh, if he said anything, then anything. But encouraged to be about the topic. More likely to be answered if it's about the topic. In the meantime, feel free to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Geeking Program. Really, like any sort of engagement, like sharing posts, tagging, tweeting at CGP, will enter you into a, I was going to say will help us, but yes, it will also enter you into a raffle where you can have the opportunity to pick a future topic for the episode, similar to our episode on Mortal Kombat 2, Annihilation, which happened in the previous cycle. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts, which is really, 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 really helpful for getting people to find the show and kind of getting us out there. So if you like this show, that is really helpful, even if you don't have anything good to say about us. If we're just garbage, then why are you listening to us? But whatever, you know, to each his own.
Say, these a bunch of garbage boys. Say that.
These a bunch of garbage
boys. I'll like
boys.
That. That'll be my favorite review ever.
Garbage boy stink man.
These a bunch of garbage boys. Just put that in.
And, you know, if you say these a bunch of garbage boys, that will be read on air because we are trying to do that, reading any good reviews that we get on the podcast. So if you want to get a little shout out like that, then that's something you can do. And whatever you do, thank you for your support and thank you for listening. We do really appreciate it, and we will see you next week. Doodly doo. This episode of the Common Geeking Program was hosted by yours truly, Jeff Levitt, joined by the representatives, Edward Ryan and Austin Liebers. This episode is sponsored by Toho Studios. Not really. That's a lie. Please don't quote me on that. The podcast is created and produced by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Jeff, as well as Taimul Chaudhary and Colin Ketchin, and featuring original music by Colin Ketchin. Next week is going to be Austin's special Creative Corner episode, so be sure to tune in for that on March 2nd. And as always, thank you for listening to this. Bye. but I think we are now going to wrap it up and move on to the ratings. A doodly doo.
The ratons.
Okay.
That's rats. That's literally just rats in French.
Of unusual size.